because they rely to a greater extent than many rich countries on corporate taxes as a source of revenue, which has to do with the sort of makeup of these economies, where you have a big informal sector where it is much harder to collect revenue and collect taxes, which means that corporate taxes, which are generally speaking easier to collect sometimes, are an important source of revenue.
Professor Vanessa Ogle, I want to thank you for being with us. University of California, Berkeley history professor writing a book on offshore tax havens. And thank you so much to Ben Hallman, who is senior editor at ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. We'll link to the articles on the Pandora Papers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
During our fall membership drive, KBOO is exploring the sounds of democracy. We are taking a deep dive in democracy in all its forms, from current events to music and culture. KBOO is your community connection. Support KBOO and get your own limited edition Sounds of Democracy t-shirt at kboo.fm right now.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. A new study says the pilot program for the Portland Street Response Team should be expanded. COVID cases are down 36% in Oregon since their summer peak. And the Biden administration lifts an abortion referral ban on family planning clinics. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 5th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our fall fund drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Portland City Council has received the first study evaluating the Portland Street Response pilot program. The program offers an alternative to non-emergency 911 calls for people experiencing a mental health crisis or houselessness. KBOO's Ethan Sandweiss has more on the story.
Portland Street Response began operating last February as a small, unarmed first responder team, specializing in mental health crises and interacting with unhoused people. According to a study released by Portland State University, the pilot program has been a success. In the Lentz neighborhood where the pilot program operates, Street Response responded to 383 incidents in 6 months, most of which were welfare checks. Welfare checks are ordinarily handled by the Portland Police Bureau. In contrast with a PPB, less than 4% of Street Response calls resulted in hospitalizations. Most medical situations were resolved in the field. Zero calls resulted in arrests. People who were interviewed about their interaction with Street Response had positive things to say. They described the team as compassionate and patient. The PSU study points to several potential hurdles in the program's future. Street Response is prohibited from handling certain situations, such as those involving suicidal individuals. Street Response members also warned that a severe shortage of mental health and addiction services in Portland could limit the long-term efficacy of the program. Street Response is overseen by City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. Although nearly $5 million are earmarked for the program, Hardesty's fellow commissioners blocked the majority of those funds until they received more data. The program has been scrutinized because some perceive it as a potential replacement for the Portland Police Bureau. At the same time, each member of the city council, with the exception of Hardesty, voted to renew a $25 million contract with a private security force, Clean and Safe, which has been accused of harassing unhoused people in situations where police are prohibited from intervening. With new data out about the program's success, the city council is poised to vote on additional funds this month. From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Far-right extremist Alan Swinney was found guilty of several charges on Tuesday by a Multnomah County jury. Swinney faced 12 charges stemming from his role in violent political clashes in downtown Portland during the summer of 2020. Swinney was found guilty on 11 charges, including unlawful use of a weapon, attempted assault, pointing a firearm at another, second-degree unlawful use of mace, and others. He was found not guilty on one second-degree assault charge. Swinney had been held in Multnomah County Jail since being arrested September 30th of 2020. He now awaits sentencing. Swinney was among dozens of far-right demonstrators on August 22, 2020, who fired paintball guns and sprayed mace at anti-fascist counter-protesters during a violent brawl. Swinney also admitted to shooting unarmed people with paintballs or bear mace on several occasions throughout the night. Many in the crowd were carrying firearms, and at one point, Swinney pulled a revolver and pointed it at the crowd of counter-protesters. He said in testimony he drew the gun because he ran out of paintballs and mace. When asked during the trial if he felt bad about what he did, Swinney said, quote, "I don't really have any feelings about it," end quote. COVID cases across the country are on the decline, but public health experts are concerned the cold winter months will lead people indoors, accelerating the spread of the virus. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
United States COVID infection rates are on the decline, perhaps signaling an end to the recent surge. The daily infection rate has dropped about 10% from a week before, and experts are asking if that is simple ebb and flow or a true and lasting decrease. They are concerned cold winter months will otherwise lead to conditions helping to spread the virus more. Cases remain very high, especially among children. Those under 18 make up 22% of our population, but account for 27% of COVID cases. Though they are less likely to have severe outcomes or die, children can end up with long-term complications. Experts are still pushing for United States residents to be fully vaccinated. According to the Centers for Disease Control, only 56% of the population has achieved that goal. 12-year-old children are the youngest allowable recipients of COVID vaccines. However, U.S. Food and Drug Administration advisors meet on October 26th to discuss data from a Pfizer trial among children aged 5 to 11. The FDA would have to vote on a positive recommendation, and the Centers for Disease Control would have to sign off before young children could be vaccinated. Approval will likely be in early November. Seniors have been badly affected by the pandemic. About 80% of COVID deaths have occurred in those aged 65 or greater. However, vaccinations have prevented at least 250,000 infections and nearly 40,000 deaths in the elderly between January and May of 2021, according to a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services report. Seniors are the most vaccinated United States demographic, with more than 94% having received at least one dose of the vaccine. Vaccinations have also benefited every racial and ethnic group studied. HHS Secretary Javier Becerra said in a statement that COVID-19 vaccines save lives, prevent hospitalizations, and reduce infections. The Biden administration has provided increased reimbursement rates for at-home vaccination, so seniors and others can more easily get this type of preventive care. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
President Joe Biden was in Michigan on Tuesday trying to build support for the social spending and infrastructure bills that have stalled in Congress amid infighting between Democrats. KBOO's Ethan Sandweiss has more on the story.
Centrist and progressive Democrats alike rallied behind President Biden's $3.5 trillion social spending package, already drastically reduced from the president's $6 trillion plan in June. However, two rogue senators threatened to torpedo the bill. In a sit-down today with Democratic leaders, Biden warned that Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin would be unlikely to support any social spending over $2 trillion. Democratic lawmakers worry these two individuals could make Biden's ambitious policies for free community college, combating climate change, and healthcare expansion impossible. Some Democrats, including Biden, appear ready to capitulate. Neither Sinema nor Manchin have named specific qualms with the bill, aside from the price tag, which has infuriated negotiators. Sinema and Manchin have received scrutiny from their party before. Sinema alienated supporters by voting against a $15 federal minimum wage, and Manchin threatened to endorse Donald Trump for a second term as late as February 2020. With a razor-thin voting margin in the Senate, Democrats cannot hope to pass legislation if they lose a single member of their voting bloc. Despite criticism of federal spending, Democratic lawmakers voted with Republicans to raise the debt ceiling several times under Trump, who added $6.7 trillion to the national debt, largely from tax cuts on corporations and top earners. For KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
The Biden administration has set a goal for all U.S. electricity to come from zero carbon sources by 2035, and it's counting on Congress to approve an ambitious package designed to reach those climate goals. But some lawmakers, including West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat, disagree on the speed of proposed emissions cuts and the paths to address climate change. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
West Virginia's Senator Joe Manchin continues to hold out on supporting President Joe Biden's proposed $3.5 trillion spending package over the cost. But climate change experts argue the proposed federal funding for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by 2035 is merely a down payment. Princeton University professor Michael Oppenheimer says climate models show the heat waves, flooding, and other extreme weather events many regions of the U.S. experienced this year will worsen without action.
As of today, what's required is not just the $3.5 trillion. That's the beginning of the government leverage, which then encourages the private sector to invest a lot more money over time in making an energy transition.
Meanwhile, a new poll by Americans for Tax Fairness and West Virginia Citizen Action Group shows 48% of West Virginia voters surveyed support Biden's spending plan, with support increasing if it were paid for by billionaires and major corporations. Manchin also has publicly stated that he wants natural gas to play a key role in Biden's clean energy overhaul. But Oppenheimer says most scientists now agree that natural gas pipelines and operations leak massive amounts of methane into the atmosphere and aren't as green as previously assumed.
That idea that natural gas could be a bridge, that idea that natural gas was sort of a safe substitute for coal for a while, is now been shown to be untrue.
He adds that funding for capturing and storing the carbon produced by power plants is a prominent feature in Biden's plan. But Oppenheimer points out there are concerns about the effectiveness of those technologies.
The trouble with it is that this method called carbon capture and storage has never proven anywhere near as economical as producing electricity from some of the non-carbon sources.
A 2020 report by Princeton researchers found that energy efficiency, electrification, renewable energy, along with biofuels, nuclear energy, and carbon capture are all possible pathways to reach zero net emissions. This is Nadia Ramlagan for West Virginia News Service.
The Biden administration on Monday reversed a ban on abortion referrals by family planning clinics put in place under former President Donald Trump. The Department of Health and Human Services said its new regulation will restore the federal family planning program to the way it ran under the Obama administration, when clinics were able to refer women seeking abortions to a provider. Known as Title 10, the taxpayer-funded program makes available more than $250 million a year to clinics to provide birth control and basic health care services, mainly to low-income women. Under former President Donald Trump, clinics were barred from referring patients for abortions, prompting a mass exit by service providers affiliated with Planned Parenthood, as well as several states and other independent organizations. Women's groups labeled the Trump policy a gag rule, and medical organizations called it a violation of the clinician-patient relationship. Groups representing the clinics said they hope the Biden administration action will lead around 1,300 local facilities that left in protest to return. Planned Parenthood, the biggest service provider, said on Twitter its health centers look forward to returning. But the group criticized part of the Biden administration rule that allows individual clinicians who object to abortion not to provide referrals. The administration said that policy is in line with federal law. Restrictive abortion laws in Texas, Mississippi, and other states have prompted a mobilization by abortion rights supporters who fear a conservative-leaning Supreme Court will overturn the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion nationwide. Hundreds of abortion rights demonstrators gathered around the country on Saturday, with one protest bringing thousands of abortion rights supporters to the court steps. The Supreme Court has allowed the Texas law to take effect, but has not ruled on the substantive legal question behind that statute, which bans most abortions in the state. The justices will also hear arguments on December 1st on the Mississippi law, which bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. A new lawsuit is challenging major policy changes made by the Social Security Administration during the COVID-19 pandemic. Emily Scott has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Disability advocates and other groups are suing the federal government over the Social Security Administration's practices during the pandemic, including shuttering its local offices. The challenge was filed on behalf of five New Yorkers who utilize Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, which helps low-income older adults and people with disabilities. In March 2020, Social Security, which administers SSI, closed all of its offices, making it difficult for recipients to report any financial changes. 6 months later, the agency started to send notices to thousands of people telling them their benefits were going to be reduced due to overpayment without giving them a meaningful chance to contest it. Kate Lang of Justice and Aging, which represents the plaintiff, says the office closure left many vulnerable people in the dark.
People have difficulty communicating with Social Security and saying, you know, this is a mistake. I'm still eligible for these benefits. I shouldn't be cut off. We think that Social Security needs to recognize that the pandemic continues.
The federal government has 60 days from filing to respond to the lawsuit. Other organizations involved in the case include New York Legal Assistance Group and Arnold and Porter. The suit also raises concerns over Social Security's streamlined waiver process, implemented in August 2020, that was meant to forgive financial penalties for overpayment during the first few months of the pandemic. Danielle Tarantolo of New York Legal Assistance Group says the waiver failed to address the pandemic-related SSI issues.
Our clients tried repeatedly to take advantage of this streamlined process and get a quick waiver so that they could maintain their full benefits. And over again, they were unsuccessful.
Representatives for the New York SSI recipients say they hope the lawsuit leads to Social Security revamping the waiver process to make sure that everyone who deserves one can get it. Social Security offices around the country remain closed to the public, except for emergency situations. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection.
You're listening to a special Fall Fund Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the relationship between health and structural injustice with David Rosenberg. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 61 degrees. Today in history, in 1947, President Harry Truman makes the first ever televised presidential address from the White House, asking Americans to cut back on their use of grain in order to help starving Europeans. Each of Truman's subsequent White House speeches was televised. The quote of the day is from South African anti-apartheid revolutionary and former president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela, who said, quote, "A good head and a good heart are always a formidable combination." The Facebook whistleblower goes before Congress, a stalemate continues over the debt ceiling, and Andrew Yang is leaving the Democrat Party. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
There's bipartisan agreement that it's time for accountability to come, and I sincerely hope that Mr. Zuckerberg and the rest of his Facebook colleagues are prepared for what is coming.
That warning from Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn, who invited Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen to testify before a Senate committee today. Haugen asserts the tech giant puts profits over public benefits and says it should be federally regulated. News recently broke that Facebook concealed data that showed the harmful impacts of social media on kids. The standoff continues over raising the debt limit.
We could easily solve this in the next 2 days and easily do that through allowing Democrats to be the adults in the room, despite the fact that Republicans spent like drunken sailors over the last 4 years before President Biden took office.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki reiterated President Joe Biden's calls for Congress to pass a standalone bill to raise the debt ceiling. Republicans want Democrats to use the budget reconciliation process, which Democrats argue is time-consuming. A federal default on debt could happen as soon as October 18th. Which economic policy director at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Shai Akabas, says would have severe ramifications.
Investors would be less confident about holding U.S. securities, which could mean rises in interest rates across the economy. It could potentially lead to an economic recession. It could lead to large drops in equity markets. It would likely lead to a credit rating downgrade by credit rating agencies.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer promised to vote this week. Entrepreneur Andrew Yang, who unsuccessfully sought the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination, is becoming an independent. On his podcast Monday, Yang discussed the need for a new political party, calling the current system fundamentally corrupt.
A reasonable person can enter and then try their best out, try their heart out, but they'll be there grinding and dialing for dollars. Someone that gives to them is going to represent some corporate interest. That's the way our system is designed. And the best thing we can do right now is to try and clean up our system so that it actually is more responsive to popular will.
Yang is known for his support of universal basic income. Hundreds of teachers and activists marched across the Brooklyn Bridge Monday, protesting New York City's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for public school employees.
This is absolute discrimination, and this is the fight for civil rights that we all need to be standing and fighting for today.
That's Angela King Stanton, a Republican criminal justice reform advocate who plans to travel to similar events in other states. The mandate was upheld by the Supreme Court. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Emergency health workers arrive in Alaska, and the Indian Health Service hosts a listening session. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Emergency health workers are arriving in Alaska as the state struggles with a surge of COVID-19. A federal disaster response team has started work at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports.
35 medical workers are stuck under the fluorescent lights of a conference room for orientation at the Alaska Native Medical Center. It's where they'll work for the next 2 weeks. Most are wearing khakis and t-shirts with bright bold letters DMAT. That stands for Disaster Medical Assistance Team. The team was called up just 2 days earlier, says team leader Gina Smith.
We landed last night. We started right away, as you could see in the other room. We're getting an orientation.
They're getting ready for shifts, working as physicians in the packed ICU, pharmacists, or even logistics managers. As part of the group, Smith has been to disasters from 9/11 to Hurricane Katrina. Since COVID hit, the team has been on the front lines of the pandemic.
We were in California when the cruise ships came in, helping with some triage and some quarantine of individuals, as well as some medical care for those that needed it when they came off the cruise ships.
Now, Alaska is on the front lines of the COVID crisis with five times the national average case rate. On Friday, ANMC announced it was operating under crisis standards of care, and doctors and nurses say they've been stretched thin for weeks. The team is made up of seasoned health workers who are taking time off their normal day jobs to work in Alaska. And they're not the only ones arriving. About 40 nurses and 10 nursing assistants started working at the hospital at the end of September as part of a state contract. And there are a handful of incoming full-time staff nurses who are getting acquainted with ANMC's IV machines at a nearby conference room.
So you hit that, and down here on these screens, you'll see all these options you can choose. So
ANMC Administrator Bob Anders says the influx of new staff may be enough to give some tired workers a break, but it won't solve the problem since hospitalizations are expected to keep rising.
We have, you know, 600 to 700 nurses here. So 40 nurses is a help, but it's as a proportional response, it still is challenging.
The new workers bring in loads of experience from traveling to states dealing with some of the most difficult times of the pandemic, and they also bring in some new energy. Certified nursing assistant Tracy Williams has been to half a dozen states over the past year and a half. She's from Georgia, but she's unfazed by Alaska.
I have seen the moose in Maine, so that ain't no big rah-rah-rah for me either.
It's hard work, and she's seen some dark things in the ICU, but she says it's worth it.
I was in Georgia for 3 days, well, 4 days, and I was here by Saturday, Sunday. That's exhausting, but it's the motivation for what you love to do. They give you that push to say, come on, girl, you can sleep on the plane.
She's hoping to give a boost to her new colleagues here at ANMC and to help Alaska get through its darkest days of the pandemic. I'm Lex Trinan.
Indian Health Service Chief Medical Officer Dr. Loretta Christensen talked about staffing and COVID-19 burnout during a listening session Monday with tribes. She says the IHS has deployed mental health support for staff, provides time off, and trains non-traditional providers for vaccination events to allow doctors and nurses to focus on patient care, and has projects to address staff shortages.
We are working on student pathways and ways to recruit more residents and young people into building our health force. We actually have a summit this month to that end where we're looking at ways to enhance mentoring and recruiting both public health and medical professionals to the service of Indian country.
The listening session was held at the National Indian Health Board's virtual conference taking place this week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Nuisance flooding is hurting coastal economies. In many communities, water spills onto streets at high tide, and the problem is getting more common as sea levels rise. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In many coastal towns, water spills onto streets and sidewalks during high tide, even on sunny days. This flooding is often called nuisance flooding, but it's more serious than that name implies.
While it feels like a small inconvenience at the time, those impacts add up to things like replacing cars. It impacts our infrastructure. It starts to weaken things.
Renee Collini leads the Program for Local Adaptation to Climate Effects Sea Level Rise, which is spearheaded by Mississippi State University Extension and Sea Grant. She says high tide flooding can harm local economies too.
It can impact the flow of our commerce, whether that's at major places like ports or at small places like local businesses.
Flooded streets and sidewalks may prevent customers from visiting stores or restaurants. And in flood-prone areas, property values may fall, while flood insurance rates go up. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports that as sea levels have risen over the last two decades, the frequency of high tide floods along the U.S. coast has doubled.
And we're looking ahead, it's going to be 5 to 15 times more in the next 30 years.
So Collini urges communities to plan now how they want to adapt. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The authorization of funding for the abandoned Mine Land Fund officially expired on September 30th. Advocates say the lapse in funding brings a new level of uncertainty to the program, which is responsible for cleaning up open mine portals and polluted streams left behind by coal mining operations nationwide. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Congress has allowed the abandoned mine land program to expire, and advocates say nationwide on both state and tribal lands, residents face uncertainty over the future of environmental cleanup and economic recovery on lands once used to mine coal. The program was reauthorized in 2006 for 15 years, but it expired September 30th when lawmakers failed to pass President Joe Biden's infrastructure bill. Chelsea Barnes with Appalachian Voices says the AML is the only source of revenue coal mining communities have to clean up health hazards left behind by the coal industry.
You know, I think we've heard from leadership it will be passed this October, but until that happens, I think you're just going to see a lot of state and tribal agencies just kind of in a holding pattern waiting to see what happens.
The bipartisan infrastructure bill would reauthorize the AML program and coal severance fee at a reduced rate and includes an additional $11.3 billion for mine cleanup that supporters argue would create thousands of new jobs in coal regions. Director of Policy and Organizing at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, Rebecca Shelton, points out that since the fund's creation, states have received a total of $6 billion in AML grants.
So what we have on the table in this Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act is not only a reauthorization of the fee in the fund, but an additional $11.3 billion. It's needed so much for our communities.
She adds that in addition to restoring the natural landscape, reducing the odds of landslides, and improving drinking water, repurposing old mine land boosts local economies.
In Kentucky alone, we have over $900 million in abandoned mine land liability, and these mine lands are old mine lands.
Experts say the full cost of reclaiming all abandoned mine sites in the nation will likely exceed $20 billion. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
You're listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 5th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kovanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Josh Salem, Ethan Sandweiss, Mary Sherman, Emily Scott, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland speaks with longtime Earth Firster Karen Pickett to discuss her 40 years of direct action and agitprop in defense of the home planet. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our Fall Fun Drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on the relationship between health and structural injustice.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. Speak Out Now recently hosted an online panel discussion on the links between health and structural injustices and how to heal our world. The featured speakers were Raj Patel and Dr. Rupa Maria, co-authors of Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. They spoke about what they consider to be the hidden relationships between our biological systems and the deep-seated injustices of our political and economic systems. KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Patel, who's a professor of nutrition at the University of Texas at Austin Lyndon B. Johnson's School of Public Affairs. Rosenberg asked him about the significance of the concept of inflammation.
The idea of inflammation is that your body is inflamed because society is inflamed, because our planet is inflamed because of capitalism and colonial capitalism in particular. And so what we're doing in the book is tracing very specifically how it is that colonial systems of healthcare and of food and of extraction, of patriarchy, of racism, have engendered certain ways of being in the world that have committed our planet to flames, and that the destruction of our planet is absolutely feeding into everything from the COVID pandemic to just the wildfires that are currently engulfing y'all over there.
I noticed you're concerned about the racial disparities in our healthcare too. We do hear about that, but you seem to be going much deeper related to what you just said. It's not just a question of racial disparity, it's at the core of the system, the way it functions. Could you talk about why the healthcare system is so screwed up? I presume that you mean more than the U.S. system, right?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, the U.S. system is particularly bad, but you're right, David. I mean, you know, the history of medicine, I mean, it likes to dress itself up in a white coat and pretend that it was benign all along. But the history of medicine has always been as an accompaniment to armed colonialism. It's not like, you know, the men with pikes and horses got off the Spanish ships, and then the doctors kind of gently dabbed the brows of indigenous people, hoping that they would get better. Medicine has always, in its modern form, been a frontline enabler of colonialism. You know, insofar as we have tropical medicine was invented to help white people colonize other parts of the world, right? I mean, that's why you have institutes of tropical medicine in colonial capitals like, you know, Brussels and Paris and London, is because certain kinds of disease were afflicting colonizers and so therefore needed to be studied. But, you know, the medicine always takes the sort of racial taint of the sites of its practice. So, for example, I mean, it is true that in the United States, things are particularly bad because we are a particularly racist society. And so, you know, there's a study in 2016 where 58% of white people thought that black skin was thicker than white skin. I mean, obviously that's not true, but it's a racial trope that, you know, has its origins in, you know, in slavery and in technologies of violence against slaves, enslaved people. And so, you know, in 2016, 58% of white people thought this, but 40% of first year white medical students also thought this. And by 4 years of medical training, 20% of white medical students still believed this, this ancient racist myth about skin. And so, you know, this is just a way of saying, look, this isn't just about the history of tropical medicine. This is about how colonialism and racism lives in medicine today, particularly in the United States. But, you know, if you look in Britain and look at who it is that was predominantly exposed to COVID and COVID-related death, in the first instance, it was people of color. And that's not an accident. That's by design.
What do you make of the argument that Ivan Illich makes about modern medicine being counterproductive, that it really makes you sicker than you need to be, and it kind of challenges people's dignity to try to heal themselves through more homespun methods, that idea?
I mean,
that's really separate from what you're talking about.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, you know, to some extent, the ideas that Rupa and I have are very much about recognizing indigenous knowledge as science And, you know, Ivan Illich recognizes, these sort of fortresses of colonial medicine as outposts of imperia, of the imperium. And so, one of the doctors whose work we follow in Inflamed is Franz Fanon. Now, people may know Fanon as, a theorist of anti-colonial, tactics, and, his black skin, white mask, and the wretched of the earth are classics for people who want to understand how colonialism works. But he was also a practicing psychiatrist. And so in Algeria, where he practiced, he tried decolonizing medicine. And one of the ways that he did that was he worked with middle-class settler French women, and he worked with them to decolonize their treatment. And what that meant for them was setting up a printing press and a film club so that they could see representations of themselves of which they were in charge, and they could circulate stories about themselves in which they could finally see themselves. And that is a way of treating their psychiatric disorders that seem to be very successful. But for working class Algerian men, that wasn't the answer. For working class Algerian men, they wanted to be outside the hospital and playing football as part of their recovery from trauma and from violence and the psychological distress that accompanied that. So, there are ways that, for example, Franz Fanon anticipates Illich's ideas that, in fact, there's something very wrong about the hospital. But, a lot of this book is based on peer-reviewed science, and we like that. Our argument is not that peer-reviewed science is rubbish. We are both double vaccinated and ready to go, and we think that there's something quite good about peer-reviewed science. What we don't like is the way that modern colonial capitalism has adjudicated who can be a peer. And so instead of saying, you should just go home and feel free to try ivermectin, what we're saying instead is, no, what we need is many more peers and recognized for the wisdom that they have held for generations, rather than dismissing indigenous knowledge and then occasionally stealing the fruits of their labor, which seems to be the sort of standard method of operation for for capitalist pharmaceutical companies.
Do you see modern medicine moving a little bit in that direction, with more acceptance of body work and Indian medicine and Chinese medicine, integrative approaches?
Yes and no, David. So we're certainly seeing, for example, a recognition now that the microbiome is important. For people who don't know what that is, humans are not just one animal. We are on our skins and in our particularly in our digestive system. We are hosts to trillions of organisms, many of which are not human. And the biome, the microbiome inside our stomachs, has a very strong association with certain kinds of inflammatory disease. The balance and the biodiversity of the things in our guts matters. And, people have been saying this for ages, that if we are living in a biodiverse community outside our bodies, there's more biodiversity inside our bodies. But what's the capitalist response to that? Well, we anticipated this in the book, but then as soon as the book came out, we saw that someone was trying to essentially turn the poop of indigenous people into a treatment. And so, recognizing that we need biodiversity, the capitalist response is, well, we're going to turn this poop into a pill, and they will have a more diverse microbiome. But the culture from which this poop comes is going to be destroyed. We're nonetheless going to deforest the Amazon. We're going to license the use of pesticides. We're going to burn their homes to the ground. But we're going to save their poop because it may save us. And that capitalist approach of extraction and sort of salvage archaeology and salvage anthropology is incredibly dangerous, because it takes rich traditions of medicine and healing and knowledge and food and reconfigures them into something that can be repurposed for individual therapy and individual profit, when the obvious way to maintain a vibrant internal microbiome is to have a diverse biome outside your body. But that, of course, is less profitable for the pharmaceutical company. So they'd rather just turn poop into a pill and sell it to you than preserve the planet we live on.
And yet you are obviously somewhat optimistic that this can all change. Do you see it changing, say, in the next 10 years?
Well, that's the big fight that we've got ahead of us. It's not clear to me that anything is inevitable. If we carry on the way that we are, it is true that we will see many, many more extinctions. We will see us pass certain points of no return when it comes, in terms of the climate catastrophe from which, many of us will die as a result. But there are already movements for land rematriation. My co-author, Rupa Maria, who is, among other things, a physician at the UCSF, but also the chief instigator at a nonprofit called the Deep Medicine Circle on Ramatush Ohlone territory, is in the process of rematriating land with indigenous comrades in order to be able to reimagine what medicine might look like when, indigenous and, Western traditions come together to heal people in ways that they've never been healed before, on the land and with care and love and with reparation in ways that are radically different from the way the medical system looks at the moment.
It just seems like there's a lot of good stuff out there on the margins, everything from sound healing to various forms of meditation and things that you mentioned. And it's kind of encroaching on the monopoly of Western medicine, I think, at least. It seems like it's better than it was a few decades ago.
It's true. When we have Nobel Prizes in medicine occasionally being now awarded to people who aren't, in the European medical tradition, that's a sign of a certain kind of geopolitical shift that then feeds into the way that medicine can be understood. And I think that that's all to the good if it's accompanied by a breaking of the way that capitalism operates. Otherwise, again, what we'll have is traditional Chinese medicine or Ayurveda or whatever it is, sold to us by hipsters who want to make as much money as they can, as opposed to recognizing that these medicines circulate in ecologies of care that are radically different from the ones that we have at the moment.
That was KBOO contributor David Rosenberg speaking with Raj Patel, a professor of nutrition at the University of Texas at Austin's Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and a research associate at Rhodes University in South Africa. Patel is one of the authors of Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for COVID Noise Filter.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Women's unheard pain. What if you had a condition that caused pain and inflammation, but when you saw your doctors for medical help, you were made to feel like the doctors didn't believe you? It's infuriating, right? Well, unfortunately, this is a reality for some women in the UK and Scotland. According to the BBC News, the Scottish government is in the process of publishing a new women's health plan after a report showed inequalities and discrimination. Upon reading the report, a UK gynecologist was shocked to learn that gender-based inequities exist even in healthcare. The report also showed that discrimination was occurring at all levels of healthcare. The new plan recommends better access to diagnosis and treatment for endometriosis, the addition of specialized menopause services, improved access to information on menstrual health and contraception, as well as the creation of a women's health champion. The new health plan recommendations are very needed, as said by Brittany Lightson, a PhD student with endometriosis, who felt the medical system was against her. She told BBC News, "I've been told in my face that the symptoms I was experiencing and the pain that I had was impossible, and that the damage was being done was something that I actually couldn't feel. The medical gaslighting has caused so much damage to women over time." Endometriosis is a condition where tissue like that found in the lining of the womb grows elsewhere in the body, often around the reproductive organs or the bowel, or maybe the bladder. Just like the womb lining, the tissue builds up and bleeds every month, but there's no way to escape the body. The blood is trapped, leading to inflammation, pain, and formation of scar tissue. For some women, there are no symptoms, but for others, it can cause chronic pelvic pain, painful intercourse, or bowel and bladder problems, and painful periods. Sadly, in the UK, it takes an average of 7.5 years to be diagnosed with endometriosis after seeing multiple doctors across multiple years. There is no cure, but treatments including hormone therapy, pain relief, and surgery can reduce symptoms. The main issues women are having are the delay between presentation, diagnosis, and effective treatment for conditions such as menstrual disorders and menopause. Hopefully, the new health plan is a step in the new positive direction and will result in effective change because women have been suffering in silence long enough. Nebraskan counties no longer reporting COVID data. In June, Nebraska stopped uploading data to the state COVID dashboard. Now the state's county health officials cannot publish COVID-19 data at all. According to the Lincoln Journal Star, this is because of the state law that prohibits releasing data on communicable diseases that could reveal the identity of any individuals involved. While Nebraska does not have a set benchmark for this, federal safe harbor laws say that any county with fewer than 20,000 residents cannot publish this information. Throughout most of the pandemic, the law was temporarily overwritten by an executive order, but this expired in early August. And because 76 of the state's 93 counties have fewer than 20,000 residents, most of the state can no longer report COVID data at all. This is even affecting counties that do not meet the population benchmark. Some health districts that can cover multiple counties are only able to report on one or few of them, and because of this, one health district had to stop publishing its COVID risk dial. While the state's 17 largest counties make up more than 3/4 of the Nebraskan population, these unrecorded rural counties have lower vaccination rates and are at a higher risk for dangerous outbreaks. While this data could be vital to the state's pandemic response, no officials in Nebraska have come out with a plan to reinstate the executive order. Instead, the state will begin releasing a weekly COVID report through its Department of Health and Human Services, giving some information about cases, hospitalizations, and vaccination rates. Vaccine cards are impractically sized. For many Americans, it's become more and more necessary to carry a record of COVID-19 vaccinations with them while on the run. Many workplaces and colleges have mandated vaccine or required routine testing of the virus. The city of New Orleans has even required proof of vaccination or a negative test to enter restaurants or bars. Because they've become a significant part of daily life, an article in the Atlantic poses an important question. Why are those cards such an inconvenient size? The cards are too large to fit easily into a wallet. They're too small and routinely necessary to be stored with records like birth certificates. The Atlantic says this impracticality is symptomatic of a generally decentralized, impractical approach to keeping record of the countries inoculated. There's no national database to keep track of these inoculations. Instead, the federal government keeps tabs of vaccines reporting at the state level, which results in an incredibly variable data. In fact, there's a chance the cards weren't meant to be used as proof of vaccination at all. The vaccine card template was originally accessible on many state government health sites, and currently, it's still on Florida's state website. While one state said they've done it to make it easier for local vaccine providers to make the cards, it also makes it easier to print fraudulent ones. One professor at the University of Pennsylvania said that a better system for documenting vaccination would have been two documents, a large document that included follow-up appointment dates and information about side effects, and a plastic wallet-sized card. Some states have attempted to supplement this inadequate documentation system by creating smartphone apps or other digital documentation systems for the vaccine. New York City created an app for verification that still has some bugs, and the state of Louisiana integrated a COVID verification feature into LA Wallet, their digital driver's license app. And this is what we're using here in New Orleans, is we're really encouraging folks to download that LA Wallet, Louisiana Wallet. Again, even if you don't use the digital driver's license app, which has a fee, I think, of like $5 to be able to use that app, they are allowing you to download the app, and it has your vaccination status there, and that is actually free of charge. And as a musician here in New Orleans who plays in bars and nightclubs, it's very, very, very refreshing and good to know that everybody that's there and the club has been vaccinated and is also wearing masks. So these mask and vaccine mandates are great with respect to being able to help stem the cases, especially with what we saw with this incredible Delta surge here in New Orleans. And so, yes, I don't think that those cards are really meant to be proof of anything except that you got them done. I will say this, I was taking care of a patient in the hospital, and he was completely vaccinated, but he was elderly with multiple comorbidities, and he proudly walked around with his laminated vaccine card around his neck to show everybody that he'd been vaccinated. And I asked him if he was just doing that just in the hospital, and he said no, he wore it everywhere he went. He'd been vaccinated in April and wore that laminated card around his neck everywhere he went. He was very proud of it, and it was a pleasure to be his physician while he was in the hospital. Investigating vaccine hesitancy. The COVID-19 vaccines are on their way to saving millions of lives globally, but for some, the vaccines create a sense of uncertainty. New research from the International Journal of Public Health has investigated that the reasons behind vaccine hesitancy by looking at the relationship between trust in scientists, medical professionals, and government organizations with perceptions of vaccine safety and effectiveness. Vaccine hesitancy is defined as the delayed acceptance or refusal to take a vaccine. A year before the pandemic, vaccine hesitancy was considered among the top 10 global health threats. But the influence of an anti-vaccine movement and the spread of misinformation online means that an effective vaccine program will struggle to be fully employed if large numbers of people refuse the vaccine. In the U.S., 93 million people eligible for vaccines remain unvaccinated, which is concerning given the potential for spikes in COVID-19 cases and the current spread of the Delta variant and the possibility of more mutations and variants occurring. Through conducting an online research in 17 countries across 5 global regions between May and June of 2020, the research assesses confidence in public health organizations and key experts and leaders and whether that impacts vaccine hesitancy. When asked if they would take a free COVID-19 vaccine if it was made available to them, just under half the respondents said either no or maybe. And the study found that older adults age 70 and above were less likely to be hesitant about vaccines. Across the countries, confidence in public health organizations in regard to the handling of the pandemic and information about viruses is relatively high at the international level, with a large majority of respondents expressing some degree of confidence in the World Health Organization. That confidence was even higher in most territories toward health organizations at the national and local level. Levels of trust in leaders and experts varied, although almost all reported high trust levels in medical professionals and scientists, many respondents expressed a lack of trust in political and religious leaders. Overall, confidence in the WHO and public health organizations at all levels, combined with trust in domestic or local government scientists and health professionals, leads to lower rates of vaccine hesitancy. Public health campaigns may also inspire people to take the vaccine of their own accord. Writing in the Financial Times, Scott Radson, a community health lecturer at the City University at New York's Public Health School and recent senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School, discusses vaccine hesitancy. He argues that boosting vaccine uptake is a case of building vaccine confidence rather than blaming or shaming people for vaccine hesitancy, while also communicating to people that vaccination is the social norm. According to the New York Times, unvaccinated people tend to be split into two camps, those who adamantly refuse the vaccine and those who are still on the fence about getting vaccinated or are waiting a while longer. The high proportion of people who answered maybe when asked about free vaccines in the survey by the International Journal of Public Health at the earlier stage of the pandemic confirms this idea and suggests that many people could be swayed by investing in public health campaigns advocating for vaccine uptake. Vaccine hesitancy and uptake has been altering globally. In France, President Macron's announcement that a COVID vaccine passport would be needed for hospitality services and transport led to over 2 million vaccine appointments being booked online. But the mandatory vaccine mandates came with their own struggles, as do mandatory mask mandates, as mass protests also erupted in response to the announcement. In the UK, vaccine hesitancy among younger people is also shifting. According to the Office of National Statistics, vaccine hesitancy has almost halved amongst young people in the age 18 to 21 group. Many young people are taking this opportunity to better protect themselves from COVID-19. And in the last few weeks, vaccine availability for 16 to 17-year-olds has also been announced. Vaccine hesitancy is constantly shifting, and higher vaccine rates are promising when considering fear surrounding vaccines last year. Although large proportions remain unvaccinated and refuse to, encouraging those who are unsure and could be swayed to get vaccinated is essential to saving lives, reducing COVID-19 transmission, and to avoid further mutations of the virus. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee will meet on Wednesday, October 13th at 6 p.m. instead of the second Monday of this month. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a finance coordinator. Our finance coordinator is responsible for accounting for and providing reports on KBOO's finances,